From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The tit-for-tat expulsions of diplomats continue today as Russia ordered more British envoys in Russia to go home. Yesterday, Moscow told 60 U.S. diplomats to leave.
The expulsions are taking place at a rate unseen since the height of the Cold War. On NBC's Today show, Russian Ambassador Anatoly Antonov said U.S.-Russia relations are at a new low.
It seems to me that atmosphere in Washington is poisoned. It's a toxic atmosphere. It's high time for us to stop blaming each other. It's high time for us to start real conversation about real problems.
Our Friday political roundtable joins us. Juana Summers, CNN Politics senior writer. Hi, Juana.
Hey, guys.
And Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good to be with you.
And Ron, the issue behind these expulsions, Russia's suspected involvement in that poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter in London this month, it's roiling international relations. And yet President Trump seems to be taking a low-profile approach this week, only issuing written statements to condemn Russia's expulsions yesterday and ordering them via a statement on Monday. No public comments from Trump. What's going on?
The president is pursuing a kind of two-level strategy, if you will. On one hand, his administration is joining the world community, NATO in particular, in condemning this nerve agent attack, not only because of its effect on actual human beings, a couple of Russians, and a number of people just in the community there of Salisbury who were totally innocent victims of this particular attack, but also because this is an extraordinary military-grade nerve gas that is strictly prohibited by international agreements, that has never been used in this way before, and that as an attack on a foreign country's soil, in this case Great Britain, that is an extraordinary provocation in this supposedly post-Cold War world. And so the United States is joining the global community in condemning that, but Donald Trump still wants to keep open his unique, I suppose, open window of communication with Vladimir Putin, with whom he fancies himself to have a special relationship.
On the issue of Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin, he was the latest Trump administration official to leave, but he did not go quietly this week when he was fired by President Trump. He'd been found at fault for misusing taxpayer funds on foreign travel and entertainment. He told NPR's Morning Edition about getting caught in a political fight over privatizing VA medical services.
I was not against reforming VA, but I was against privatization. And I think that it was really the political appointees that were trying to undermine our efforts at VA.
And we should also say that Shulkin mentioned on Morning Edition that he was not misusing taxpayer funds for a trip to Europe. This was not an excursion. This was a work trip. And he had prior approval for the expenses. So now that Shulkin is out, I wonder how the sides are lining up, Juana, for and against privatizing veterans' medical services.
So one of the things I cover the VA, and one of the things I heard from veterans groups as these rumors started to bubble up that Shulkin could be out any day is they were really worried that President Donald Trump would nominate someone who would be for moving more care for the nation's veterans into the private sector. And I want to be clear about something. About 30% of the nation's veterans right now actually receive some care in the private sector. What we're talking about when former Secretary Shulkin says privatization is allowing veterans unlimited choice. And I think that now they're quite worried, frankly. We heard the president speaking at that campaign-style event in Ohio yesterday. He said he wants to allow veterans to be able to run to a doctor. He said he made changes because he didn't like the speed at which the nation's veterans were able to receive care. And when I spoke to veterans groups and lawmakers on Capitol Hill, they say that worries that Ronny Jackson, the White House physician who the president says is his pick, while we don't know a lot about his policies, they say that makes them concerned that they will open this up to this so-called unlimited choice to move more care into the private sectors, something that that opponents of that policy say would actually end up dismantling the VA system altogether, and that the private sector actually can't accommodate the 9 million veterans which the VA serves.
Ron Elving, is this the kind of thing that President Trump would have talked to Dr. Jackson about before making him his nominee, whether or not he favored privatization?
One would imagine that would be a necessary part of any conversation if indeed this were the issue that underlay the whole relationship with Shulkin going south. You remember last summer, after Secretary Shulkin had helped the president get a reform bill through Congress, remaking the VA in the way that the president wanted, the president said, "We're never going to say you're fired" to our David, referring to Shulkin. "You're fine. You've done everything we wanted." He was enormously positive. So for this to have changed so much, perhaps it had to do with that trip to Europe, perhaps it had to do with this other issue of privatization. But if it did have to do at all with the issue of private care, you would think the president would have had that discussion with Dr. Jackson. On the other hand, or Admiral Jackson, I suppose we should call him because he is both. On the other hand, we really don't know what kind of conversations he may have had with his apparent new pick to be the secretary. And it's not clear that Admiral Jackson has much familiarity with that particular issue as it pertains to the VA. He may, but we just don't know.
I think there were a lot of people when they heard that President Trump had nominated the White House physician to replace Shulkin, they thought he was talking about Jacob Bornstein, his private doctor, who wrote the letter saying that he could state unequivocally that Trump would be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. But it wasn't that guy with the long hair.
He was pretty glowing, though, at the same time.
Exactly. Juana, do you expect there to be more departures from the administration next week? Just this month, they've lost Hope Hicks, the communications director, National Security Advisor McMaster, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Economic Advisor Gary Cohn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Take a breath.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, the president's opinions and feelings about some of the top aides in the White House, they really change on a dime. So it's hard to predict. As I've been talking to my sources, we've all kind of been joking back and forth that the best way to answer that question is just to watch the president's Twitter feed. A number of these departures that have happened, I think there have been eight over the course of March alone, including some of the people you just named. We're finding out about on Twitter, despite White House aides going on, news organizations going out and speaking to us and saying, you know, there are no personnel changes to report. So I think the best guidance I would give is that that's a question that only really the president and those who are very close to him can answer. And sometimes not even his chief of staff knows, as we've reported, when he's going out and making these decisions that somebody's going to get shown the boot.
One thing we've observed in the past is the president also watches who is showing up in the media. And Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, is on the cover of the new Time magazine. It's quite a picture. And it says no man is above the law. And it's interesting to speculate how that might strike the president.
Meaning positive or negative,
based on how flattering it is? He has not been happy with other people being pictured on Time magazine cover, such as Steve Bannon.
There is news today, environmental news, that the Trump administration is moving to roll back some tough Obama-era car emission standards. How significant do you think this is?
I would say it's enormously significant because this is part of the legacy, not only of the Obama administration, but of several administrations stretching back years all the way to the Arab oil embargo back in the 1970s. The idea that we would try to have more efficient vehicles, that we would enforce that through the law, and that has made a tremendous difference in terms of oil consumption in this country and also in terms of pollution. If we're going to back off of that regime, and it isn't just from the Obama years, if we're going to back off from that kind of commitment, it's going to mean a great deal to the fate of the United States, not only the economy or perhaps the energy industry economy, but also to the environmental situation in the United States going forward.
We cannot go through this week without talking about the Stormy Daniels fallout after her 60-minute interview. She asked about whether Trump was aware of a $130,000 payment that his lawyer Michael Cohen claims to have paid on his own to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels before the election, allegedly to keep her quiet about a 2006 affair. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders would only say that the president has denied the allegations. And on CNN with Aaron Burnett 2 days ago, Cohen's lawyer, David Schwartz, said this.
Look, Michael was the fixer. We all know Mike. So
yes,
it could be anything. It's not that this matter. There were a ton of matters that took place that Michael fixed. And Donald Trump wasn't involved in every single matter.
As Stormy Daniels' attorney said, he's more than happy to drive David Schwartz to television interviews because he helps Daniels' case so much. Juana, how much trouble is the president in here?
I think we don't know quite yet, but what we are seeing is an attempt very publicly by Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, to put pressure on this White House. That's why I think you saw him making an attempt this week to perhaps see Michael Cohen and President Donald Trump deposed. The president has been publicly, incredibly, very quiet on this matter. It's clear it's a story that neither the White House nor the president himself want to engage in, and we're seeing it play out in headlines and on cable news networks. They're trying to get the president to say something. He's not doing so far. And to your point, from what you said, you mentioned that Sarah Sanders has said, you know, that the president has denied these claims. But to be clear, they.
Oh, sounds like we lost Juana there. Ron, you want to pick it up? Oh, we've lost them both. So we will now wonder instead whether they are playing this at Mar-a-Lago this weekend. Okay, so our guests have returned to say goodbye. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, and Juana Summers, CNN Politics Senior Writer. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you both.
It's Here and Now.
New Jersey is one of a number of states trying to tighten gun laws following the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. This week, the state assembly in New Jersey passed a number of measures. The Democratic-controlled Senate will take up the bills next, and New Jersey's governor, who's a Democrat, has voiced his support. The provisions include a limit on the magazine capacity of guns and a ban on ammunition capable of penetrating body armor. No surprise, these changes are controversial. Alexander Rubian is president of the New Jersey Second Amendment Society. He was one of a number of people who protested outside the statehouse this week, and he has pledged to sue the state if the measures pass. Hi, Alexander.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Thanks for being here. We want to go through some of the provisions to hear specifically why you oppose them. One provision would limit the magazine capacity on guns to 10 rounds. So that means that somebody who wants to shoot more than 10 bullets at a time could not legally do that. Do you oppose that?
Absolutely. It limits an ability for a woman specifically to be able to defend herself.
Against whom?
It could be against one individual or five or six other individuals. We've had instances in New Jersey where specific towns were targeted in home invasions where 5 to 8 people were breaking into people's houses to cause violence.
So you think in that case that one person would need to fire more than 10 rounds of ammunition at a time?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. You know, we don't have a magic wand here or a magic ball here to figure out what the circumstances are. But why should any individual be limited to how they could be able to defend themselves?
Should there be any limit at all as to how many rounds a gun could fire?
Well, individuals should have the ability to protect themselves. Criminals obviously are going to commit crimes no matter what. What happened in Parkland, that individual used 10-round magazines. So to make the argument that it's okay to commit violence and horror with 10-round magazines is just losing sight on the issue.
A number of Republican state lawmakers are pushing for a different bill in New Jersey for bulletproof doors. Others have called for arming teachers. Is that what you would like to see?
Well, they're not calling to arm teachers. They're trying to change the law so that teachers, like the ones that are in my organization, that are competitive shooters and very proficient when it comes to self-defense and shooting firearms, won't be barred by federal or state laws to be able to protect the students.
But let me ask you this. There are people who have spoken out against these moves in New Jersey who are saying, look, something has to change. We have to stop demonizing the other side, no matter what the other side is. Do you think that anything has to change? I mean, you can't be any happier than anybody else about what we're seeing in terms of violence, not just in schools.
No, absolutely not, yeah.
But of course, but other places as well. So what do you think should change?
Well, the only thing that should be changing is that government enforce the laws that are already on the books. You know, the fact of the matter is that the people that in New Jersey are being arrested with firearms, the first offense that they plea bargain away are the actual illegal possession of a firearm. So if we wanted to be really firm on quote-unquote gun violence and reduce the amount of deaths, we should start convicting and prosecuting the people that are actually committing the crimes. and not going after law-abiding citizens that, you know, just want to exercise their constitutional protected right.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I know you're a champion of the Second Amendment. That's written into the name of your organization. The Second Amendment doesn't say what kind of ammunition you can have, how much ammunition you can have, how many bullets you can have in a magazine. This is not something addressed by that. So how do you see this as an infringement of your rights?
First, if you're limiting an individual's ability to protect themselves for self-defense purposes, wouldn't you want that person to have the maximum ability to defend themselves?
Maybe, we don't make maybe the argument, in keeping with the threat. Well, I mean, if there's a militia that's at your door, that's one thing.
Well, you can't predict that. I mean, are there going to where is the next terroristic threat going to occur? If there's one person or if there's 100 people on my front door looking to commit violence against me, you know, I should have the greatest ability to protect myself.
Does it bother you when we hear about, when we talk about law-abiding citizens, and the vast majority of gun owners are indeed law-abiding citizens? Nicholas Cruz in Florida was a law-abiding citizen.
Nicholas Cruz had many red flags, and that was a massive failure on the government's part, that now the Democrats and the left are looking to expand those powers for the same government that failed on Nicholas Cruz.
Well, wait a minute. Just get back to Mr. Cruz himself. I mean, when
yes.
we're talking about whether or not he should have access to those guns, he did have access. So instead of talking about the Democrats or Republicans, I mean, what could we do about something like that that would have prevented what happened?
There were many red flags that should have been reported that would have prevented Mr. Cruz from being able to acquire, possess, and own firearms.
So do you support wider background checks?
No, the argument here is that the background checks we had in place that was supposed to be based off of the reporting of the government, reporting of the schools, mental health professionals, that infrastructure, that system failed. That was a government error. That wasn't an error of lack of laws.
I wonder if you're surprised at the momentum that has resulted from that particular shooting in Florida.
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that their agenda is to ban the Second Amendment and to repeal the Second Amendment.
Do you really believe that?
It's their words, not mine.
That's the words of some people, but it's definitely not there in the proposal that we see in New Jersey or any other state to ban the Second Amendment. That's not what is being talked about.
Well, they know there'd be a massive outcry.
It's also not an effort.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, in New Jersey, we have no Second Amendment. In New Jersey, you're very limited to the types of firearms you're able to purchase. I mean, I'm limited to a lot of different types of guns that I would like to personally own, but I can't because they're banned and illegal in New Jersey. They wouldn't, you know, our argument and our position is always going to be there's enough laws on the books. Let's work on making sure those are being enforced and our databases are updated with any individual that could be a threat through mental illness or some type of violent crime.
Alexander Rubian is president of the New Jersey Second Amendment Society. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
For the past 15 years, Iraq and the United States have been intertwined. Serving in Iraq changed the lives of the American troops who fought there and the lives of Iraqis, too, both civilians and soldiers. NPR's Jane Araf is caught up with an Iraqi general in Mosul and has his story.
Before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, Iraqi General Najm al-Jabouri would stand at the border crossing with Turkey and look longingly at the other side.
Just I have a dream to go outside Iraq. Sometimes I went to Ibrahim al-Khalil Gate just to see outside Iraq, to see the ground in outside Iraq different from Iraq.
He was a brigadier general, and he'd never been out of the country. Even having foreign friends was dangerous in Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
When the United States came to Iraq, we think we'll breathe the freedom, and we will come like Europe. Because before, Iraq like big prison.
Jabouri says most Iraqis were happy when Saddam Hussein was removed, but they suffered when security declined and religious parties took power. For every Iraqi, the last 15 years has been full of unexpected twists and turns. We're sitting in a garden at what was Saddam Hussein's palace complex in Mosul. Jabouri, a two-star general, commands it now. He's 62, a trim-looking man dressed in a tan camouflage uniform. A U.S. surveillance blimp hovers overhead, watching over the city liberated from ISIS last year. American soldiers wearing shorts and army T-shirts jog down the road.
They advise us.
He says the U.S. forces advise them, provide reconnaissance, intel, and air support. Shaburi got to know American forces when he fought al-Qaeda with them. Later, when he finally left Iraq for the first time, it was to the U.S. He came back to Iraq 4 years ago to help command the battle for Mosul. Now his family is in Virginia, and Shaburi is here, in what is probably Iraq's most complicated city. We go inside to a large office. It's Wednesday, the day Shaburi sets aside to hear citizens' problems. He's gathered together other security and government officials. And for the next 9 hours, his doors will be open.
Level 10.
Because while fighting against ISIS has ended, there's another battle he wants to win. It's for the people's trust.
My view, who win the people? He will win the battle. Who win the people, he will win the battle.
Mosul after ISIS has been turned upside down. There are dozens of people waiting to see him. Older women walk in and kiss him on the head in a sign of respect. One woman tells him when she and her husband returned to their village, their house had been burned and looted. Graffiti accused them of being ISIS. Your sons, Shaburi asks her, are they ISIS? She says only her grandson was. Shaburi calls an army commander and asks him to make sure she can move back to her village. Some women are searching for relatives taken by ISIS. Another says her husband and 17 other relatives were arrested 3 years ago by a militia working with Iraqi security forces. They haven't been heard from since.
They arrested 18 men. Now in my family there are only women. We don't have any men.
It's a huge problem here. Months after the battle ended, Shaburi is still trying to get a list of prisoners being held by the Iraqi Interior Ministry. Despite the turmoil, Shaburi says he's optimistic about Mosul. He says people need hope and they need to trust their security forces. He's trying to rebuild that trust. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Mosul.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Comedian Bill Cosby is back in a Pennsylvania courtroom today for the second day of pretrial hearings. His retrial on sexual assault charges begins with jury selection. That's next week. Cosby's last trial ended in a mistrial in June. A jury failed to reach consensus after 6 days of deliberations. WHYY's Bobby Allen is covering the story. He joins us now from Philadelphia. Bobby, more than 60 women have come forward to accuse Bill Cosby of sexual misconduct, but this trial deals with one accusation. Could you remind us about the case?
Sure. So, yeah, the statute of limitations has expired on nearly all of those 60 that you mentioned, except for one, Andrea Constant. Prosecutors actually filed the case against Cosby on her behalf just days before the legal clock ran out. So there's a lot of drama around that. And they have a long history. They met some 15 years ago. Constant viewed Cosby as kind of a mentor. She'd go to him for career advice. But then one night in 2004, she went to Cosby's suburban Philadelphia mansion. And that's when she says Cosby drugged her with pills. She thought she was taking Benadryl to deal with a headache. She now thinks it was much stronger than that. She passed out, and she says Cosby sexually assaulted her while she was incapacitated on Cosby's couch, completely powerless.
So even though this is a retrial, there will also be some major differences between this case and the last one, including Cosby's legal team. Tell us about that.
That's right. So, yeah, change in legal team, but also important here, change in legal strategy. So last time, Cosby's defense attorneys were able to deadlock the jury by basically arguing that Cosby and Constan were kind of willing lovers, right? That they were kind of, mutually pursuing each other romantically. And it's very different this time around. His defense attorney is... this group of defense attorneys, rather, are basically saying that, Constan had this cynical scheme to frame and extort Bill Cosby to get rich. Cosby has, last time I counted, 7 defense lawyers led by this guy, a Los Angeles-based guy, Tom Mesereau, who I think is best known for winning an acquittal for Michael Jackson back in 2005.
Different accusers as well.
There's different accusers. There are, 5 additional women who will be taking the stand against Cosby. Most legal observers I've talked to said that's going to be a huge benefit to the prosecution's case.
In what way? I mean, how could their participation affect the trial?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think having 5 women take the stand against him is going to change the tone. As a quick reminder, there was 1 additional woman who took the stand against Cosby last time. So the judge let in 5 this time. Their cases date back to the 80s. And, prosecutors are hoping that having these 5 other women will help sort of establish like a pattern of drugging and assaulting women that they hope will portray Cosby to the jury as this serial predator who always got away with it.
Bobby, briefly, the last trial of Cosby ended in June. By last fall, the hashtag MeToo movement had become a force. To what extent do you think that might change the tenor of this trial?
Yeah, actually, there was an event back in January that Cosby did this like strange comedy routine. And I asked him myself about this. I said, Bill, how do you think the Me Too movement is going to affect your retrial? And he kind of contorted his face in this kind of goofy frown and said, I don't know. And he made this gesture with his hands indicating, he wasn't sure. But regardless of what Cosby thinks, obviously the Me Too movement has been a powerful cultural force. And, it's obviously on everyone's mind. And, whether or not it's spoken about, it's unthinkable to imagine it not lingering in the courtroom during this trial.
Bobby Allen is covering the Bill Cosby trial for WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Roboticists at MIT have created a robotic fish named Sophie, short for soft fish, that moves remarkably like a real fish when it swims underwater. It doesn't produce bubbles or noise that can disturb living underwater creatures, so it can be used to study ocean life up close. And joining us now is Robert Kochman from the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT. Robert, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you've brought some props with you here, but describe this robotic fish for us.
So Sophie is a fish that is made of a soft tail. So the posterior, like the back half of this fish, is made of a rubber material. And Sophie can go in the ocean and uses the water of the ocean inside of its tail to cause a fish-like swimming motion. And we use that to explore the ocean.
I've seen a video of this, and we'll post it at hereandnow.org, but it looks kind of like a real fish.
Yes, and that was definitely something we were going for. Like, the whole development of this robot was with the intention to use this soft material and, like, hydraulics to actually make a fish that can look and feel and also swim like a fish. So when you put some sort of force or pressure into this tail, then the motion that is created looks like a fish and it swims similar to the strokes of that tail. They call it the undulation, meaning the tail, it undulates like a fish.
How does this compare to previous versions of robotic fish?
So previous versions of the robotic fish would traditionally use motors, a whole series of motors that are connected with rigid links, and you have to bring them into a very like coordinated motion to simulate a somewhat undulation of a fishtail.
Now, I read that one of the things that you did was that you had to fill the head with a small amount of baby oil. What is that about?
Well, so in order to go deep, in order to go down to depth as a normal diver would go, we have to make sure that Sophie doesn't compress too much. So all of the parts that shouldn't touch water, meaning the electronics, they have to be protected. So we used an oil, and all of these chambers were fully filled with oil and then just closed off.
What else is on the inside of the fish?
So we have a pump that takes the water and circulates it back and forth within the tail. We also have a battery, and we have a fisheye camera, and we have a little controller board, and we have an underwater microphone that listens to like remote control signals.
And for Sophie, acoustic signals are very important.
For Sophie, acoustic signals have the importance of high-level commands. So Sophie can be told commands about, please keep going to your left or keep exploring to your right. You have a diver several feet away, and the diver tells that to Sophie. And it happens every second that Sophie gets a ping from the diver using ultrasonic sound waves.
I hear that many of the components of this are 3D printed.
Yes. So like all of the molds that we used to make the tail are 3D printed. The tail itself is made of a silicone elastomer. It's a type of rubber. Otherwise, the hull and the nose and all of these things are made of 3D printed material.
Now, you've got several tails in front of me. Tell me about the difference between these.
So I brought these tails to give you an idea about the development of Sophie and the different stages we've been to. A lot went into casting this fishtail and like tuning the size of the interior, ballooning like these hollow sections, but also getting the material right. So when you touch them, some of them feel soft, some of them feel harder. And so there was a lot of development just to get the tail in the right shape.
What is the biggest challenge of a fish like this?
So the biggest challenges are to first get the tail motion right so that you actually can swim. So just wiggling doesn't do the job. You have to get that motion right so it actually swims forward. And also then swim into turns requires control on the tail. And then the other challenge is to just get it go into depth, like overcoming the pressure and not starting to sink very quickly.
How deep have you sent this thing?
About 60 feet deep, so 18 meters.
And is that the ultimate goal, or do you want to go way deep down?
We definitely want to go deeper. But for those first explorations, we were also just, I myself, I'm not certified to go deeper as a diver. So we had that as our first limit.
And how fast can Sophie go?
So right now it goes at half a body length per second. That's about 28 centimeters per second. I am not good in converting that into...
Well, I have never heard of things measured in half a body length either, but is that something you do?
That's something very common because when you look at locomotion of robots, you want to understand it's in scale of the size of the robot. Like how fast are you going in relation to how big you are?
What's been the biggest surprise for you about this?
The biggest surprise was when I was designing this and testing it in a pool, and actually when we first got in the ocean and that we could deploy it and the things worked, luckily, like the communication to Sophie, the swimming at different depths that I never tried before, that was actually very surprising to me.
And if Sophie breaks, does she float to the top?
So if Sophie breaks, Sophie will float to the top. And we just like collect Sophie and then fix whatever's broken and bring her back in the ocean.
How do other fish react to this fish?
So we had a various set of reactions, but mostly they were not bothered by Sophie. So most fish were continuing in their path, they continued swimming. We saw some fish swimming alongside of Sophie and just following Sophie. And some other fish, especially when they were very small, we could see them swimming away. I assume it was just the size and the eye facing forwards, but that's just a guess of mine.
And are you worried that Sophie will be eaten by a bigger fish?
So I'm both worried but also curious to get the video footage of that.
How do you hope that Sophie is going to be used?
I hope that Sophie can be used for studying the ocean. And I think there are several aspects, like studying how other fish behave, study interaction between robots and fish, but also to use Sophie with its camera, but also additional sensors that we plan to add to Sophie to actually study pollution, to study change in temperature, and other factors that affect the oceans.
Again, it's a really interesting video to watch. What's been the reaction to this that you found?
So a lot of people love, they think it's mesmerizing to see Sophie swim and mm-hmm. to move its tail. And a lot of people feel convinced that going in this direction can open up a new field of underwater research and understanding the interactions with actual real fish and with marine life.
So what's your dream with this?
So my dream would be to have a school of Sophie like going through the ocean and be helping humans to gather information and to learn more about the ocean and the things we have not learned about yet.
And you can do that better with something like this than with a submarine?
So I think there's two aspects to it. A submarine has a different way of propelling itself. It causes like a jet that comes out of the back of the submarine, mm-hmm. and those things are not as natural to the marine life as the tail motion of Sophie. But also the sheer cost of Sophie, the simplicity of the mechanism, we only need one pump to cause the whole swimming to happen and also to turn. While with propellers, you might need more than one propeller or additional elements. I think that by itself is promising to lower the cost for deploying a whole school of Sophie.
That's Robert Kochman, who is a roboticist in the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT. We'll link you again to this video of the fish, the robotic fish, Sophie, at hereandnow.org. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Each little clam here, no hot a jam here under the sea. Each little slug here, cutting a rug here under the sea.
The NCAA men's Final Four basketball games take place tomorrow. In the opener, Loyola Chicago takes on Michigan, and later it's a showdown between two number one seeds as Kansas plays Villanova. As always, the games could be decided by free throws. Well, our next story is about a free throw that did not make a difference between a win or a loss, but it did mean a great deal more to a couple from Iowa. Martin Kessler from NPR's Only a Game has our story.
Chris Street grew up in a small southern Iowa town called Humiston. He was tall and coordinated, and in 1990, he reached his dream of playing for the University of Iowa Hawkeyes.
Slicing through the lane and setting up Street.
By his sophomore year, Chris was a starter. And as a junior, he began approaching a school record. For 24 years, the Iowa record for consecutive made free throws had stood at 33 straight. When the Hawkeyes visited Duke in mid-January 1993, Chris had made 32 in a row. His parents, Mike and Patty, watched from home.
CBS Sports welcomes you to...
How are you both feeling going into that game?
Nervous.
Late in the first half, Chris went to the line for two shots.
First one went in pretty good.
Replaced them. That ties the school record.
The second one kind of rattled around a little bit, but once it went in, the house kind of exploded.
We exploded.
We were very excited for that.
We were ecstatic for him.
Yeah.
Just ecstatic for him.
After the game, Patty left a message at her son's apartment.
Telling him how proud we were of him and congratulations, but I never did get to talk to him.
3 nights after Chris set the record, on January 19th, 1993, Patty was closing up the family's mom-and-pop convenience store when her husband showed up.
I knew something was wrong when he came. And he said, it's Christopher. And I said, oh, did he blow out a knee? Because I thought, oh, he blew out a knee, you know. And Mike says that he told me, but I did not listen. I wouldn't listen.
Chris's car had collided with a snowplow. Chris was pronounced dead at the scene. In the weeks after Chris's death, Mike and Patty attended some of Iowa's home games. They wanted to be there to support Chris's teammates. Eventually, they stopped going. The games brought back too many memories. But they were always proud of Chris's consecutive free throw record.
It was very special because, you know, as a parent who's lost a child, you don't want people to forget him. And I guess with that record, it was just another thing to remind people not to forget him.
And then this past January, Chris Street's free throw record started to face a serious threat from a guard named Jordan Bohannon. Just like Chris, Jordan had grown up in Iowa, dreaming of playing for the Hawkeyes. Jordan enrolled at Iowa in 2016, and just before his freshman season, he met Mike and Patty Street at a team banquet. After decades away, the Streets had started attending Hawkeyes games again.
Talked to them a little bit, and obviously I knew a little bit about Chris, but I wanted to learn more.
There just seemed to be an instant bond, actually.
There was. He's this warm kid.
A warm kid and a great shooter.
And there's number 30, Bohannon. Two more in the well.
You know, we were watching it close. It was one of these feelings that I had. I wanted him to break it because he's such a good person, good Hawkeye family person. We always said, who better to break it, you know, than Jordan?
And we'd had 25 years, and I guess that I just kind of thought, well, maybe we've had our time.
But yet at the same time, as a mom, you'd like for your own child to keep it too. So it was just a flip-flop there for me anyway.
In mid-February, Jordan Bohannon hit his 31st and 32nd straight free throws. A little over a week later, Iowa hosted Northwestern in the final home game of the season. Mike and Patty Street were in the stands. Late in the first half, Jordan tied the record. And then, with 2 minutes and 15 seconds left, Jordan Bohannon went back to the free throw line.
Here's a chance for Jordan Bohannon to become the all-time consecutive made free throw shooter.
I think Patty said, here we go.
I think I did say that, didn't I? Here we go.
He's made 34 straight. And he does miss it. So he does not break the Chris Street record.
Jordan's shot clanged off the front of the rim.
Patty looked at me and said, "Do I do that on purpose?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so."
But he did.
Yeah, obviously that's not my record to have, and obviously that record deserves to stay in his name.
For weeks, Jordan had been planning to miss that 35th free throw.
I'm like, "Oh, Jordan, you shouldn't have done that for, you know, Christopher. You shouldn't have done that." You know, that's what I kept telling myself. But then as you have time to think and you're like, wow, what an incredible, incredible act of respect and kindness.
The Iowa Hawkeyes didn't make this year's NCAA tournament. But when Jordan Bohannon and the Hawkeyes take the floor next fall, Mike and Patty Street will be in the stands to cheer them on.
It just brings back a lot of good memories now, and it's not the hurt. So in that respect, it's wonderful.
For Here and Now, I'm Martin Kessler.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.